Warning, this podcast has stories of real-life events and true crime that happens every day. These stories may contain adult language and graphic or disturbing details not suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised. In our society, most people are content to go through their daily lives safely and peacefully. But our society is not always safe or peaceful. For that reason, some men and women answer a higher calling to defend and protect their fellow man. You probably know someone who is one of these people, or maybe you are one of these people. The ones who see and do the things most people would never want to. These things are sometimes heroic and beautiful, but often they are horrific and terrifying. It's these things they don't share about with other people. It's these things they carry with them, so you don't have to. But when they get together, they talk to each other about them. And they call these stories war stories. Welcome to another episode of the War Stories Podcast. I'm Tom.
And I'm John.
And we are back for another episode, and we've made it through a lot of craziness. Mm-hmm. So as we told you, we wanted to get back to actually sharing stories. And I promise you this episode's not going to be an exception to the rule, but the rule. We've had some great feedback. We just did our live episode with, it was like six or seven other podcasts. Yeah. It was really cool. We met some good people, some different issues. Dispatch podcast, security, private security podcast, like executive protection kind of thing. We had Nick from the roll call room was arranging it all. It was pretty good. Mm. Sorry you couldn't be there.
It is what it is. I had to work. But I got to listen to a bit live while I was at work, and it seemed to be flowing just fine.
Yeah, it seemed to be going good.
Yeah, it was nice.
So that was kind of a bonus for you guys. It was a little bit of an extra episode to some extent if you watch the video. Let us know if you don't watch the video and you don't want to. We can always put the audio of it up. Sure. I just haven't because
I feel like people have asked for like YouTube video. Like they want to see us talk.
Right. And so we're going to toy with, because we'll be launching, it sounds like, the midweek podcast next week. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, John can't be there for our
weird worst
episode of that, just because your schedule changes.
Yeah.
Matt's agreed to join me for that, and we've got another guest coming in from our original podcast to kind of ring in the relaunch or the midweek podcast. So look for that. It'll be a little bit different than this one. Obviously, we've talked about it, but it'll be fun. I think you'll like it.
It'll be a good thing.
Yeah. Today, however, we want to get right into it.
Yeah, let's do it.
Why don't you introduce us to Alex here?
Yeah, Alex and I have worked together in past years. And first of all, thank you for being here. I know it's kind of a drive for you, man.
No problem.
But if you don't mind, why don't you give us a little background on yourself and what you do?
So, like John said, my name is Alex. I work for a police agency here in Southern California. I'm on my 10th year as a police officer. However, I've been in public service probably about 25 years now in different capacities, but as a peace officer for the past 10 years. I work some hard areas, and I recently moved to another area. I've had anywhere from minor infractions all the way down to some pretty serious arrest.
Not against you.
Not against me. I've recovered weapons, narcotics, guys trying to steal police cars from our own station.
Yeah.
Stolen vehicles, the whole. So I got a little bit about everything you can do in police work.
Now, real quick, because you said something that I think our listeners, at least the civilians, might want to understand. Yes, police officer and peace officer pretty much are the same thing. There's a little bit of a different classification. Not all police officers are peace officers, but not all peace officers are police officers. So a sheriff's deputy is a peace officer.
Right.
A police officer is a peace officer. So it's a legal category of law enforcement, just so you know. So if you guys hear that phrase, I mean, I don't know that we've ever addressed that.
I don't think we have.
But I know people have been like, what's the difference? So Therein lies the difference. So you did 25 years in public service. What was the first 15?
Well, the first 10 I did, I was a social worker.
Okay.
For LA County. And good job. A lot of cases. And you actually see a lot of interesting families or, you know, the struggles that these families go through. It's kind of a tough job, and it just gets tougher as it goes along, because the better you are at the job, the more cases they give you.
Gets.
Yeah, they just want to give you more work because you're like, oh, this is a great employee. Let's give him more work.
Right. And then the guy who doesn't do a good job
just
makes the same money but skates.
Yeah, we get the same paycheck, but, you know, they get about 50% less of the cases. I was averaging on a monthly basis, I'd say probably about 100 new cases, while my counterpart was averaging 25, 30, because they said, hey, this guy can handle the work, so let's just give it to him.
Yeah, beat you like a rented meal.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So after 10 years of getting the beat down like that, you know, it's, you figure, okay, it's time to move on. I left there. I went into the private industry for a little bit. Kind of didn't like it. I went back to LA County, and I went as a firefighter for LA County Fire. After that, I was dumb enough
You're sleeping too much?
No, yeah. I was dumb enough to leave the fire department, and I said, well, let me, I want to be a police officer now. Yeah.
Fucked up.
And that's what I did. I have no idea why, and everybody always wants to beat me over the head.
Yeah, I have one friend, well, I knew him years and years and years ago, who became a police officer because it was easier to get on the police department than the fire department at the time. So he just stayed a cop for the, you know, 2 or 3 years while he was applying to get on the fire department. And then as soon as he got on the fire department,
later.
Peace, I'm out. But I've never heard it go the other way.
I have
no idea.
Well,
now you have.
Oh, man. I got in the wrong line at the academy.
Oh, that's all right.
So I saw them run around the academy with all those ropes, like with knots tied to their belt.
It's too hot for that.
And then they drop one and you'd like bring it back and then you expect them to get yelled at. And no. Oh, here's your rope back.
The best thing about the fire academy is it got me in phenomenal shape. I used to be like in phenomenal shape. I mean, it's mostly all cardio. You do cardio. You're in the academy for, you know, let's say you're supposed to be there 8 hours. You're there for about 10, 12, whatever it is.
Right.
And for about 6 of those hours, you're probably doing cardio.
Well, they got to prep you for all the working out you're going to do on duty. Because that's like, there's gym in the fire station. And if there's not a call, you're either cooking.
You know what's funny?
Polishing the truck or working out.
Well, Nick, I had just spoken to Nick. I mean, we've had Nick on the podcast.
Yeah, yeah. Nick was the infamous wood chipper.
Nick had just made a comment to me the other day. He's like, man, he's like, I thought like this time, about this time in my career, like it was time to slow down and go to a slower station, because I never actually got to experience what everyone talks shit about.
Right.
I never got to sleep. I never got to hang out. I never got to watch movies.
Exactly.
And I'm like, really? I'm like, I thought you all do that. Yeah. He's like, nah, man.
And that's one thing I've learned is being a firefighter is very much about what area you get assigned to.
Yeah, sure.
And I guess to some extent law enforcement is too.
Yeah, I believe that. Yeah.
But it seems like shitheads are going to shithead no matter where they're at. However, the medical aids and the fires don't happen in equal measure.
Sure.
All, you know, across the county lines.
Sure.
So a firefighter, and then you screwed up and went to the police academy.
Went to the police academy. I did breeze through the police academy because
you were in shape.
And I will admit, the fire academy was like 10 times harder than the police academy.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I believe that.
Physically or?
Physically and mentally.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, but we're going to edit that part out.
Yeah, I don't.
No, I don't.
I believe
it,
100%.
Yeah. Hey, but being a cop is just, it's just way cooler. It's just way cooler.
Yeah, that's true. So you've been on the job 10 years? This is not technically an on-the-job story.
No, this is not.
All right. So this would be, because this is something that doesn't get, well, hasn't been talked about really so much on this show.
Mm-mm.
But the number of off-duty incidents and things that happen to firefighters, police officers, people in the military off duty can have just as big of an effect on you, because your duty to act is internal, not external.
I was going to say, that's when everything that you do on the job should take over outside the job as
well. Shit. Well, the floor is yours, man. What's your story?
So back in October 1st of 2017, not sure if you guys remember, but it's actually the largest victims and casualties of an active shooter in the United States. There was 58 people that died at Route 91, and me and my wife actually just happened to attend that with a couple of other coworkers. So my story actually starts, you know, I'm a big country music fan. I just love country music. I don't know if it's a cop thing, but it's like the music speaks to what my thoughts are, you know, to my patriotism for the country. That's just what country music is. Yeah. Right. That's what it is for me. So anyways, me and my wife are at Stagecoach in Coachella, and we're at the pool area because we got this Airbnb. My coworkers are there, and my wife is a very chatty person. So she's chatting with them. I can hear it, and they're like, hey, we're going to go to Route 91. You guys should come with us.
Wait, so you were at... When you said Coachella, I'm like waiting for the... You say, I'm sorry, I misspoke. You were really at Coachella.
Yeah, we were there.
This is where the story starts.
Wow. Right. Okay.
You were not listening.
No, right. I was listening, but I thought it was somehow wrong. I'm like, Route 91, now Coachella?
No.
I missed the memo.
So she plays a trick on me. She comes over and she's like, hey, guess what? And I already heard this whole conversation they're having.
Right.
Jason Aldean is like, he's like my favorite singer. And she comes over and, hey, guess what? Jason Aldean's going to be at Route 91. So I'm like, yeah, I know. She's like, you want to book? And I'm like, I already did. I had already booked like tickets to go, but now she ruined like my big surprise. So anyways, fast forward a couple months, same year, 2017. We ended up going to Route 91. I had never been to a concert like this. This, you know, usually concerts, you got the VIPs and you got the general admission. This one is kind of the same thing, but the VIPs actually... If you're looking at the venue, the VIPs are actually on the outsides, and they have their own private little balconies and stuff like that.
Right.
The general admission, you can literally go up to the artist, and you're like a foot away from them. So you just got to push your way in. And
right.
So I have never done that.
Get through the pit.
Yeah. So the first night we were there, I thought, oh,
is
man.
Is there a pit at a country concert?
Yeah, that's okay, exactly what it is. The first night we're there, I'm like, this is great. Like I paid, I think it's like $100 a night. It's like $300 tickets. And I'm like, well, this is great because you get to go all the way right up to the front and you get to see the artist. So we were having a great time. The first two nights we had a great time. The first night we actually didn't find our friends there. But the second night we actually found them. There were so many people there that we actually ended up splitting up into two groups. Great night. But what I'm actually going to talk to you about is the third night, obviously. Right. Mm. You know, usually when you're in the police academy, one of the things they tell you is, hey, you're going to feel like the hair in the back of your neck and you're going to know that something's wrong. And I'm like, hey, this is bullshit. This is just the spiel they give everyone. I got that feeling, the morning of, and I didn't listen to it. I woke up that morning on October 1st with the biggest stomach ache, like in the world. I woke up in the morning, and what better way than to get rid of a stomach ache than to go to McDonald's and buy a sausage McMuffin,
yeah,
right?
A little grease.
Right? Yeah, that'll fix you right up.
Yeah.
So anyways, me and my wife did. We had a timeshare over there. We went across the street to McDonald's, bought my meal, big stomach ache. I took one bite, and I told her, hey, I'm going to go to the car. I feel like throwing up. So I left her there. I went to the car, and I
strange
did.
Strange reaction to McDonald's breakfast.
Yeah. I know. It never happened before. I did. I started throwing up, and she came out. You okay? I had already promised her we were going to go do the outlets thing.
Now, because the listeners are going to ask, you weren't hungover.
No, not at all. You might not believe me, but I don't drink.
Right,
I don't
that's drink why any alcohol. John had mentioned that. So, like, you know, was kind of that thing of you definitely weren't hungover.
No, nope. Not hungover at all.
Right.
Anyways, I end up taking her to the outlets. My stomach is just killing me. I find a nice bench to sit at with all the other husbands that are there at the outlets. I sit down on the bench. She does her shopping. She comes back. She sees that, you know, I'm a little green. She ends up telling me, hey, let's just go to the hotel room. You can get some rest. We do. We end up going back to the room. I end up taking a nap. And then about 12:30, I get a text from one of my coworkers that was at the venue already. And he's like, hey, man, I saved us some spots. So he sent me a picture of the spots that he had saved us. And I was like, okay. I ended up taking a nap. I woke up because my wife was actually blow drying her hair. And this was about 5 p.m. And she's like, hey, get ready. And I told you, Jason Aldean's like my guy.
Right.
That's
you're like,
someday.
I'm already ready.
Like, yeah. This is day three.
That's like day three.
This is my moment.
Last night, right. Jason Aldean, we're going to go out with, you know, we're going to get crazy tonight. I end up telling her, hey, I don't feel like going. And she's like, what? Like Jason Aldean, he's your man. He's your favorite singer. I said, I don't feel good. And she's like, come on, just get ready. You're going to feel better. And, of course, you know, you got to please the wife. So I did. I ended up getting ready. As soon as we walked out of our hotel door, no more pain, no more, everything's gone. I feel like 100%, and I'm like, we're gonna kick some ass tonight.
You had mentally committed, and so your brain decided to shut off whatever else it had going on. Once you had made the commitment, it said, okay, fine, if you're not gonna listen to me, I'll just...
We're doing this.
We're doing it.
Yeah.
And it's funny, is like we prep our bodies like that every day for work. Mm-hmm. Once you set your mind to going to work and putting on your suit, that's it. Everything else goes away.
That's it. No more pain.
Yep.
I felt great. We got in the car. We shot right over. We ended up parking at the Mandalay Bay. I'll tell you about a little bit about the setup. You park at the Mandalay Bay, and then you go through the casino floor. You actually make it towards the front exit. So it's Las Vegas Boulevard. Mm-hmm. And here's some of the things I noticed. You're a cop, so you're always noticing stuff. You know, right. Wherever you go, it doesn't matter. Right. Yeah. I noticed there's a motor cop. They didn't hire very many police officers for this event.
Because they were all there.
Yeah, that's right.
It was all cops and firemen or vets.
There's an older guy. He's a, you know, maybe a retired guy that came back. He's a motor cop.
He's on drop or something like that.
His only job is to cross people from the Mandalay Bay to the venue. That's all he's doing. So I'm like, okay, he's wearing that funky fluorescent vest.
Oh, the DOT vest that they mandate?
Yeah. So I noticed that, like, oh, man, this poor guy, this is his job. Hopefully he's making $1 million an hour or something for what he's doing. Anyways, once you cross the street, you actually get to the venue. Here's the VIP kicker. The VIP kicker is if you have VIP tickets, you go straight into the event or to the venue. If you don't, you walk about 50 million miles to another entrance.
Right.
So anyways, seriously, you walk about 100 yards down Las Vegas Boulevard, and then they decide to loop you around. You walk 100 yards back. Then you finally get to the entrance. You go through metal detectors. I did go through the metal detector, and I remember I walked right through, and, you know, you put your hands up like you're going in a club.
Right.
Because you're used to that stuff. And I remember something went off on me, and I was like, oh, my God. All right. No, I'm good. I secured my weapon.
That's legit fear. Like, when off-duty cops go through metal detectors and they beep, they go, oh, shit. And the first thing you think of is, did I forget to take it off?
You know what's funny? I think we do it so often that I got so comfortable with it that I just try and hide it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just like, beep, beep, beep. I'm like, it's behind my belt buckle. They probably won't feel that.
You're right. Anyway. Yeah, and we'll get into, because I want to get into the decision to carry or not.
I've actually gone into places going through metal detectors, and they don't even find where I have.
100%.
So a man who shall remain nameless has a backpack from a company that shall remain nameless that has a concealed carry pouch in it. And this man made it into Disneyland. And they wanded him, or metal detected him and his girl, and they opened his backpack and went completely through it and closed his backpack up and handed it back to him with a 3-inch Model 60 357 Magnum in it, and he didn't realize it until he went in looking for something and felt the weight of it. So it happens.
Yeah,
it happens.
Go through the metal detectors. They have a security guard, obviously, because I went off, put my hands up, and he's like, don't worry about it, man, just come in, you're good. And the first thing that I thought in my mind is, shit, I should have brought my gun then.
right
first thing I thought, right.
I could have brought my gun.
Yeah. So you go through, first thing you see is all the vendors, all the food carts, all that stuff. You know, I'm looking for my friends, but there's 22,000 people there. So it's going to be kind of hard to find. We go up to the front of the stage and, you know, we're doing our thing, looking for my friends, but it's kind of hard to find. So usually what happens at this concert is when the main performer is done performing, people go to the restrooms, they go buy more booze, souvenirs, whatever. So, you know, everybody kind of disperse. One of my buddies is 6'7". He wears a white cowboy hat all the time. And I'm like, once these people are gone, that's who I'm looking for. Right. We're going to find our buddies.
Sure.
So it worked just like a charm. You know, people go do their thing, and I'm like, yep, there they are. So we end up going. The spot he saved us, I'll give you the outline. So if you're looking, like, vertically at the stage, it's going to be like a big T.
Right, so it's a parking lot, one big stage.
One big stage.
Right, and it's the typical outdoor stage made of metal, you know, grid and beams and stuff like that. Then you say there's VIP on the sides.
VIP on the sides.
So there must be like bleachers, risers, something
like that? Yeah, it's risers on each side.
Okay.
It's almost like they have like their own little hotels. They have like balconies. They can party on the balcony. They have their own little rooms and stuff.
Like boxes at a sporting event.
Exactly.
But portable.
Exactly.
Okay.
The stage, it's like a big T. It actually has like a narrow walkway where the artist can perform. You got, you know, a midsection that separates the left and the right side of the crowd. And then at the end of that stage, the narrow part of the stage, the artist usually, what they do is they jump off, they go high five all the people that are against the rails and stuff.
Right.
That takes you all the way back to, it's like a white tent with all the audio visual equipment and all that kind of good stuff that runs the lights and.
Sure.
So that's where we were. We were actually on the left side of the stage, all the way back by the audiovisual tent, all the way in the corner. That audiovisual tent is separated by a gate. It's about 4 feet tall. And it's
like those typical steel gate
right,
barriers.
That's exactly what it is. So that's where we're at. We're excited.
Now, I'm thinking audiovisual tent is way back at the back, but you're saying it, this one was up towards the front,
this
off
one
to
was,
the side of the stage.
Correct. Okay. This one was right in the center of the stage.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say right in the middle of the front of the venue all the way to the back of the venue.
Mm. Got it.
Interesting.
So I have no idea why they set it up, but it was a big yeah. white tent yeah. right in the
Clearly
middle.
They had a reason.
Right. So anyways, we're excited. This is our last night. We're with
and
all
your boys
our,
coming on.
My boys coming on. We're with all our friends. We make it to them, and we make it to them. It's actually really crowded. I mean, obviously, last night everybody's getting wild, right? So when we get there, there's actually very limited space. But there's this male Hispanic guy, real tall. He's like 6'2", and he's been hanging around with my coworkers all night. He's in law enforcement as well. So, you know, they found something in common. They were chit-chatting all night, and they kind of just ended up staying there. So this guy sees us come in. He sees there's no room, and he actually tells me and my wife, hey, man, you guys are little. You guys go ahead and go in front of me. So there's only enough space for my wife to go in front of me, and then I stand behind her. And then he's actually to the left of me. What we've been doing every night, my two girls, my oldest girls, are in the military. They're in the Navy. One of them's a big country music fan. That's my oldest. So we end up FaceTiming her. Every night we FaceTime her like the first two songs of the concert.
Mm-hmm.
She just loves country music. She's just, you know. So she does that. My wife says, hey, let me borrow your phone. I'm like, nope, not tonight. She has to work tomorrow morning. It's Monday. She's like, no, give me your phone. So anyway, she ends up taking the phone. Jason Aldean comes out. And usually he'll do like the first two songs. And then he goes into kind of like a little intermission. He'll go into the intermission and he kind of talks about like he's not a big performer. You're not going to see dancers come out or none of that. But he's going to sing his ass off. And, you know, he's going to go all night until the venue says, hey, get the hell out of here. So anyways, that's what we're doing. My wife is FaceTiming my daughter. First two songs are done. And I'm like, give me that phone. So I get the phone. And I'm like, hey, let's take our last selfie. Right. That's my words. Let's take our last selfie. So anyways, we end up taking the selfie. And if you look at this creepy selfie I took, you'll see the Mandalay Bay in the back, in the background. You'll see me and my wife. We're wearing our cowboy hats. We love country music. We're all decked out. So anyways, I get my phone back. He starts his third song. When he starts his third song, that's when all shit starts happening. So the first thing that happens is we're, you know, obviously we're watching him perform and all that. But we all turn to the right, me and my coworkers. We all turn right because we hear what it sounds like. If you ever heard those string fireworks, you light one and they all start going off. That's exactly what it sounded like. So me, you know, I come up with this crazy idea. I'm like, okay, somebody lit fireworks. They threw them. It landed on someone's girl. And now two dudes are going at it because the crowd made a small circle. And now you could see smoke coming from that bottom of that circle. So I'm like, oh, it's a ground and pound right now. Somebody's fighting. And we all kind of looked at each other. We all kind of said the same thing. Like, what kind of idiot would bring fireworks here? You know, like, we're just trying to have a good time. Concert continues. The singer continues. Nobody knows what's going on. Those were actually the first shots that were being fired. And those were like test shots.
How many you think?
It had to be, I'd say, at least 10 shots.
Okay.
But they were like back to back to back to back. There was no pause in those shots. That's why I thought, okay, they're string fireworks.
So when you say, like, you're talking pop, 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 like, that's when I imagine string of fireworks. it's this uneven cadence of the fuses rapidly detonating in succession. So you're saying it was uneven rapid fire sounding.
Right.
Okay.
And I mean, I know gunfire, you know, I've been around it, obviously. I know the sound of gunfire. It didn't sound like gunfire to me. It did sound like fireworks.
Well, the distance now we know from the point of the sound, and you're closer to the point of impact, so you're hearing
distance,
gunfire in a different way than you've ever heard it.
Yeah, right. It's bouncing off.
It's bouncing.
Yeah,
right.
Right. I mean, yeah. There's going to be echoes throughout this whole thing.
Sure.
Plus, there's another aspect that people don't think of. When your brain is not ready to process it as A, it will automatically try every possibility, even though A is the most obvious answer. It's going to go, that can't be that, until the moment it realizes it has to be that.
Right. You're exactly right, because that was my assumption. Two dudes are fighting. Someone threw fireworks. They landed on a girl. You see it all the time. Right. Like, you know, dudes fight all the time at country concerts.
Occam's razor. The simplest answer is always the right one.
Right. It's not till the next set of rounds that are coming off that we all kind of look at each other and say, hey, this is not fireworks anymore. It was about 15 seconds, I'd say, between the first, what we thought were fireworks, till the next ones. But the next ones, now I know it's an AR-15. Because the sound is completely different.
So you think the first rounds were from a different weapon?
I think it was a different caliber. Maybe his test shots, he was using something different just to kind of gauge. But now I know. I've heard this sound before. I do it when we go and qualify.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, we all looked at each other. And my buddy, the one that's 6'7", he actually yelled at everybody. And he's like, hey, everybody get down. As soon as he said that, that's when you'll see Jason Aldean on that video. He runs off stage, and that's when you know, oh shit, this is serious. This is serious business here. So everybody does. Actually, he stops playing. What ended up happening to our group is everybody ended up jumping to the right side. So they took cover behind that gate. For some reason, and I have no idea why, I ended up going left. When I went left, I heard a lady say, hey, my husband got shot. So when I turned to my left, the same guy that had given us his place was on the floor. I ran over to him.
The tall guy.
Right. I ran over to him, and he had a gunshot wound to the right side of his head. You know, through life experience, through training, when you see brain matter coming out, you pretty much know there's nothing I'm going to be able to do for you.
Right.
He was at that point. He was still breathing. He was on the floor. She was actually on top of him. And I went over there. I tried to render aid. And I already knew, hey, there's nothing I'm going to be able to do for this guy. I actually seen him. He took about 3 breaths. And then you'll see him take his last breath. And you'll see his chest just sink in. And you know, okay, this guy's done.
Right. The light goes out.
Yeah. So I know he's done. I end up grabbing. Now, let me tell you, his girlfriend, wife, whatever she was, she's probably about 5'4", maybe 120, 30 pounds.
And you said this guy's like 6'6".
This guy's about 6'2".
6'2", okay.
I end up grabbing her with both hands, and I end up trying to rip her off of him. And I'm like, hey, he's gone. Now, just remember, throughout this whole thing, gunfire hasn't stopped.
Right.
You know, usually you'll hear pop, 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 and then you wait for that reload. Okay, they're reloading.
Right.
No, I don't hear any of that. I just hear it going. And I do hear the rounds, and I hear them going off some part of that gate, because you could hear, you know, that ding,
ping. The ping.
Ding. Yeah. So at that point, I'm trying to rip her off, and one of my coworkers yells, hey, Alex, what are you doing? Get down. So when she said that, my coworker said that, I end up turning towards her, and when I turn to my right, I end up seeing a security guard. He's wearing a yellow shirt, and he's in that audiovisual tent. He's standing. That audiovisual tent is about 12 inches. It's one step. It's about 12 inches. He's actually standing up on there. When she calls my name and I turn to the right, I actually see him fall off that stage. So the first thing I think is, okay, this dude got hit too. I end up leaving where I'm at. I end up jumping the fence, and I go find him. He's face down. His upper torso is actually on that walkway. His lower torso is still on the audiovisual tent. So I end up grabbing him by the legs. I actually pull him into the tent, and we take cover behind, there's like this black, I don't know what you'd say, like casing, some kind of audiovisual equipment.
It's the Anvil road cases with all the electronics.
Yeah. And I'm like, okay, this is pretty good cover. I end up pulling him there. I flip him over, and I notice the same thing. He's got a gunshot wound to the right side of his head. It's kind of the same thing as the other guy. I got brain matter already coming out, and I'm like, okay, there's nothing I can do for this guy. We kind of just stare at each other, and like I really don't, I don't even know what to tell this guy. He's just staring at me. I'm staring at him, and he does about, he does the same thing. He takes about three or four breaths. Chest goes up, you'll see it go down, and you know he's done. So now I'm like, okay, I got two bodies. There's nothing I can do. And this is, I think, where like all my training kicks in. I'm like, all right, you got to calm down. You know, it's time to calm down. The first thing I want to know is, where's that gunfire coming from? So what I end up doing is I end up going all the way to the edge of the audiovisual tent, and I'm kind of just peeking my head out. Gunfire, I still haven't heard a pause in this gunfire. It's still been simultaneously. And at this point, I'm thinking, okay, there's got to be multiple shooters. There's no way one dude's, you know, sending all these rounds downrange.
Right.
Now what I'm hearing is like an AR-15, but now I'm hearing like an AK-47. So I'm hearing like gunfire at the same time from different weapons. You know, and they have very, like an AR-15 is more like a pop, 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 pop. To me, AK-47 is more like a taka, taka, taka. You know, it's just a different sound.
Right.
And I'm hearing all of that.
Low caliber size, yeah. Weapon operation.
At some point, I even think, okay, I think I'm hearing a handgun going off. Like somebody shooting rounds with a handgun. Anyways, I pop my head out, and I'm trying to find out, okay, where's this gunfire coming from? Because we're going to go in the opposite direction of that gunfire. I do peek my head out. Mandalay Bay is like right in my sight of line. Or line of sight. And I do see flashes coming from the Mandalay Bay, but it doesn't appear to be gunfire flashes. I'm like, okay.
What's the distance?
The distance is about 400 yards.
From diagonally, like as the crow flies, from where you're standing at to that window is about 400 yards.
Right.
Okay.
So I'm like, okay, this is a strobe light. It looks like a strobe light to me. Obviously, it's not matching the gunfire. There's echo. But I'm thinking, okay, well, that might be where it's coming from. I'm really not sure. And if it is coming from there, I'm thinking, okay, it's coming from other places too, because I'm hearing multiple guns going off at the same time. At this point, I remember, oh shit, I left my wife on the other side of that fence. So I end up leaving the security guy. I make it back to the fence. Before I jump the fence, I hear a guy say, hey, please let us out of here. So I end up going, and they have these latches on the fence that you can lift and actually open the gates. I end up pulling that latch. I kicked it. I punched the shit out of it. That latch didn't move. It didn't budge at all.
It was just stuck.
Yeah, I'm thinking because everybody took cover, they're putting all their weight on it, and yeah, there's no way I was pulling the latch.
Sure.
I end up telling the guy, hey, I'm sorry, I can't pull this open. I end up jumping that fence back over. I make it over to my wife and my coworker, and I notice they're sitting kind of like in a prone position, and they're both with their arms straight down. They have all these people there on top of them, and I'm like, "What are you guys doing? Get your fucking heads down! Like, what are you doing? Their heads are exposed."
And clearly, he's targeting heads.
Yeah,
you know that.
And they're like, "Well, my wife tells me we can't even move," so they're basically pinned to the fence.
So by people.
Okay. So at this point, I'm like, shit, like, you know, you have so many things going through your head. I don't know what else to do. I end up pulling them both by the hair. I pull their heads down, and I'm like, fuck it. I just throw myself on top. I'm like, fuck it. Hopefully if a round hits me, it won't go through, and, you know, it is what it is. I do that. There's still no pause in that gunfire. And, then the guy to the left of me, he's like, oh, shit, I just got hit. I end up letting their heads go. I end up going over to the guy, and I'm like, where'd you get hit? He's like, on my leg. I end up pulling his jeans up, and this is when I knew it was an AR-15 for sure. I pulled his jeans up, and he had a through-and-through on his almost all through his ankle. Luckily for him, I'm like, this is an AR-15 because the velocity was so fast that it actually went through and it actually cauterized his wound.
Nice.
He had bleeding, but it was very minimal. It didn't hit an artery. It didn't hit anything, you know, nothing vital. So I ended up letting that guy go, and I'm like, hey, you're good. You're going to be good. You're fine. And he's like, okay. I end up going back. Now, keep in mind, we're about 4 minutes into the shooting now, and I still haven't heard that pause that I'm waiting for. We're 4 minutes into the shooting, and I'm thinking, okay, these guys are in. This is a coordinated terrorist attack. This is not an active shooter. This is a terrorist attack. I decide, that's when I make the decision. I'm like, okay, it's time to go. We can't stay here. If we stay here, someone's coming in. They're going to spray and pray, and we're all done.
Well, yeah, we all remember the theater in Bataclan, whatever the theater was, where the band was playing, and the guys just walked in. I mean, what's to say this isn't the first wave of that?
Right. So at that point, I tell my wife, hey, let's get the fuck out of here already. And she tells me the same thing again. She's like, I can't move. So what I end up doing is I end up jumping that fence. I go into like that little area where it's like a media walkway. The artist comes down. I end up putting my hands over the fence, and then I just rip her out of the crowd. You get that, you know, that adrenaline strength, and I just ripped her like straight out. Here's the human side of me. When I did that, we were both wearing our cowboy hats. Hers, I ended up watching hers go forward. Mine actually fell backwards. And believe it or not, like my human side of me, I actually let her go. I turn around to go pick up my cowboy hat.
Right.
I'm hearing rounds hitting the fence right where I'm standing. You know, the ricochet coming off the fence. And before I grab my hat, I tell myself, what are you doing, you idiot? Right. You're going to die over a hat.
Right.
You know, not even a Stetson, you know, no. It's a cheap-ass hat.
You get it.
Yeah, but that's the human side of me.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just, you know, things that, you just don't think about. You're like, oh, shit, my hat. And I went down to pick up my hat. I'm like, what are you doing? I end up pulling her over the fence. And that's when I did something that we're basically trained not to do. I end up grabbing my wife. I put, just like a suspect, put my hand on her shoulder, one on her waistline, and I just start pushing her. My wife cannot run from here to there without collapsing. She's not a runner. So I decide, okay, I'm going to push her ass out of here. We take off running. We ran maybe about 25 yards. And then I stopped and I was like, what are you doing? I did exactly what I was trained not to do. I'm fucking leaving everybody behind.
But you had another fish.
Right.
You had your wife. And that changes the dynamic, period. End of story. You got to get her to safety first.
Right.
Before you can do anything else.
So at that point, I make the decision. I'm like, I'm not going to do it. I can't leave everybody behind. I end up turning around. I bring her back, and I throw her in the audiovisual tent. She had never seen a dead body before. I've seen them before. It really doesn't bother me. Those did, because that was different for me. You know, these were people that were just having a good time. It wasn't a suspect. It wasn't a piece of crap that you meet on the street. It wasn't a meth head. It wasn't, these are like innocent people.
It wasn't
people.
A call for service. This was more personal.
Right.
And there's a difference between seeing someone dead and watching someone die.
True.
There's a fundamental difference there. And people who haven't experienced either can't understand.
So I end up placing her there. I think this is a good cover spot. And then she starts freaking out. I pretty much yell at her and tell her just, hey, shut up. Just wait right here. I end up going back to the fence, and I basically end up yelling at everybody there. I tell them, hey, let's get the fuck out of here. They're coming in. Those were my words.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw terrorists coming in or anything like that. That was just my assumption that was
what was happening. Assumption at that point.
And the orders to get the fuck out is the right way to go regardless. So
when you say you went back, so is this where I'm assuming – a lot of people are, but then also your coworkers are there too? Or is at this point, everyone's just kind of spread out and you're just talking about a group of random people that just happen to end up there?
Yeah. Are you still with anybody other than your wife that you're connected to?
Honestly, I went back for my coworkers. Okay. They were all there. They were taking cover. The only reason I decided to leave, I thought 4 minutes is way too long to take cover anywhere.
Right.
Sure. But like I said, you know, your training tells you don't leave people behind. That's not what you do. So they were there. I actually yelled at them. But luckily, the whole crowd that was in that little corner actually ended up getting up.
Sure.
And everybody started taking off running. So I was like, all right, good. You know, I went back, grabbed my wife, the same thing, left shoulder, waistline, and I just pushed her out. I have never served in the military. I have never seen any combat like that. But I do know that when we were running out, to me, it seemed like it almost seemed like a movie to me. You're running, and then the person to your right, you just see him fall to the floor, and you're thinking, did they get hit or did they just fall?
Yeah,
like you're not sure. And then you have to make the decision, do I stop and help that person or do I get my wife out of here? At that point, I made the decision, okay, well, one of us has to make it back home to the kids. We got young kids still. So I make the decision, we're not stopping, we're just moving. So we're moving along. We are running southbound now. And we make it to... My whole thought was I do not want to go back to Las Vegas Boulevard. If I go back to Las Vegas Boulevard, where I think the gunfire is coming from, the terrorists are going to be waiting for us there. They know everybody's going to go on Las Vegas Boulevard, and that's where they're going to spray and pray. I'm running away from Las Vegas Boulevard. I'm not running to Las Vegas Boulevard. So we make a decision to keep running. I hear someone behind me, and it's one of my coworkers, and he says, hey, Alex, I'm right behind you. I turn around and tell him, hey, man, just stay with me. We're going to get out of here. We make it to the first fence, which is like a, it's just a regular chain link fence, and it has a like mesh on it, black mesh. By the time we got to it, people had already taken it down. So that was real easy. We just jumped right over that fence.
Sure.
We kept running. We got to the next fence. We ran, I'd say about another 200 yards. Like I said, my wife's not a runner. I'm just pushing her all the way through. We get to the second set of fence, and this fence is just different. This is an iron fence with spikes. It has a brick of pillars, iron fence, spikes, pillars. It's about 6 foot of spikes, 1 foot of pillars, six, you know, and right, it just keeps going.
Wrought iron and concrete cinder block fence.
Yeah. I know my wife. She's not athletic.
She's not going over it.
She's not going over those iron rods. I'll tell you that. I already know that for sure. I'm like, that's where I'm going to. I'm going to that pillar. That's where she's going to jump, right there. We make it to the pillar, and I tell her to jump. And she's like, I can't jump that. Keep in mind, the pillar's about 6 feet. She's like, I can't. Again, you get that adrenaline strength. I had, even though I told you before I was in good shape, I was not in good shape at that time. I ended up getting her like a rag doll, and I threw her right on top of that pillar, from the floor to the pillar. So I tell her, jump down. She's like, I can't jump down.
Right.
Of course. So she's sitting on the top of the pillar, just like a pigeon. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to jump the spike. I'm going to pull her down, and we're going to go. That's what I was doing. I climbed the fence to jump the spike. And before I jumped, a girl to the left of me, she's like, hey, please help me. I end up turning to the left, and she actually got impaled in the fence.
Oof.
Luckily for her.
Wait, she asked, please help me after she'd been impaled.
After she'd been impaled.
So you look over and see it. Oh,
right.
Okay.
Now, when I did look to the left, she wasn't the only one. There was a lot of people getting impaled in that fence. Luckily for her, it went through. She was wearing jean shorts. It went through her crotch area of the shorts, went all the way up, and came out through the top button of her belly button. So it actually only went through her clothes.
Through clothes.
Yeah, it hadn't gone through her skin.
Yeah, she's just super lucky, especially in the area where you're talking.
Yeah. Yeah. So she's pinned there on her shorts. She's a little heavier set. So she's like, please help. I try to lift her, and there's no way. I can't lift her at all. So at that point, she starts panicking. She's going crazy. She's yelling, and I basically yell at her. I told her, hey, shut the fuck up. I said, this is what we're going to do. I'm going to count to three. When I count to three, I'm going to fucking push you as hard as I can. And you're going to throw yourself back as hard as you can. And we're going to rip through your jeans. And she's like, okay. So she does. I'm like, one, two, three. I push her. She throws. And she actually ends up ripping right through the jeans. I remember she ends up falling on the floor. She lands right on her ass. And we kind of just staring at each other like, the human side is back, and we're just looking at each other like, that shit, is this really happening?
Right.
I see her get up, and she takes off running. And then here I come again, and I'm like, oh, shit, my wife's still sitting up there like a pigeon. I end up jumping the spikes. I end up grabbing her off the bricks, and we end up running. I see a patrol car, which is really good. I'm like, okay, there's two cops right there. We end up running to the patrol car. He has his lights on, and we go to the back of his patrol car, and there's two officers there, and they have about 40 people taking cover behind the patrol car. So I actually end up placing my wife behind the people. I end up stepping over people. I pull out my flat badge, and I tell him, hey, man, I'm a cop. Give me a rifle. And he's like, what? He turns around, and I've seen that look before. I've seen that look before at my work, and it's he's in shock himself. And he ends up elbowing me in the stomach. He's like, get the fuck off of me. He elbows me in the stomach. And then I'm like, wait, maybe this guy didn't hear me. He's like, I'm like, hey, man, I'm showing him my badge. Give me a fucking rifle. I'm a cop. And he does the same thing again. He's like, get the fuck off of me. He elbows me in the stomach. I saw that look before, and I'm like, this guy, not to take away from him, we all react differently, but I knew he was going to be of no service to us.
Right.
He wasn't going to be able to help us. I already know he's in panic mode. So I end up making the decision, okay, we can't stay here. I end up going back. I get my wife, and at this point, I still hear gunfire. But now it sounds like someone's ringing a church bell. It's a different kind of sound. It's like those, they ring those church bells, and it's the long, vibration, and it just keeps going and going. So I'm like, okay. But I still hear the gunfire. We make it to a building, and a building that has these pillars. So what we end up doing is I'm like, okay, we're going to take cover behind these pillars. I tell my wife I'm going to count 1, 2, 3. Every time I say 3, you're going to move to the next pillar. And that's basically what we do. We work our way down these pillars. 1, 2, 3, move. 1, 2, 3, move. And I'm hoping, okay, well, in between pillars, if we take one, we take one. But this is the best cover we got. We make it to the end of that building, and we get to an alleyway. The alleyway has vehicles parked in the alleyway, and then it has a building. So I'm like, okay, this is perfect. We're going to take cover between the cars and the building. That's the best cover we can get. So I tell her, run in between the cars and the building. We do. We end up running in between the cars and the building. We get to door number 17, or I call it lucky door number 17. And a guy ends up opening the door. Freaky stuff. I don't believe that it's meant to be and all that kind of stuff. This guy's name is Alex, too. Alex opens the door for us. We tell him, hey, they're shooting at us. Can we come in? And he's like, yeah, just come in here. So we end up running in there, and there's more than just me and my wife. There's, at the end of the count, there's 62 people that took basically refuge in this building. This building has 3 rooms. I end up taking my wife to the furthest room I possibly can find. In order for a round to penetrate, it would have to go through 3 walls to get to her. So I'm like, this is great. This is the best room. I end up placing her between a rack and the wall, and I tell her, stay here. And this is where I just got torn up. It tore me apart. She's standing there, and she tells me, where are you going? And I told her, well, I'm going back. And she's like, no, you're not going back. You're not on duty right now. I have never felt pain like that. It's basically like you just became the biggest coward in the world. Like someone just sucker punched you. And so we start arguing. I tell her, what are you talking about? We've talked about this before. We've had 1,000 conversations about the what ifs. And she ended up telling me, well, if you go back, I'm going back with you. To me, like, it was like my mission was accomplished. My mission was one of us was getting home to the kids. And I was done. She was there. I knew she was going to be fine. At some point, She's going home to the kids. Well, she told me that, and she rocked my world, man.
This wasn't part of the plan.
Yeah.
Damn,
wasn't
it. Part of the You're plan. Messing up my idea.
Yeah. It got really bad that people even came. They thought it was going to be like a domestic violence that was going to take place. And honestly, the thoughts that go through your head is, one of the thoughts was, I'm going to fucking punch her right now and knock her out. When she wakes up, I'll be gone.
Yeah, like a drowning victim.
Yeah. So at that point, you got to decide, do I go back with her? And then I risk that she's not going to make it home. And then I'm going to have to explain to who's going to be able to live with that shit. And it destroyed me. It destroyed me. She already knows how I am. You know, it wasn't about hero shit. This isn't about being a cop. It was about seeing people taking bullets and just dying in front of you. And I was like, you know, with my training and experience, if I can go back and just get one more people, maybe instead of 58, it would have been 57. All the what ifs come in.
Sure.
So at that point, I decide, okay, I'm not going to go back.
Right.
It's the worst feeling in the world. At that point, I'm like, okay, well, what can I do while I'm in here? I went around and tried to find other cops. There was a lot of cops at that venue. There was no cops there, but there was two Marines in there. What we ended up doing is we came up with a plan. They had already started securing doors before I even made contact with them. And they were making weapons out of broomsticks that were there. They were shaving them down and, you know, making weapons. We came up with a plan. Since there was three rooms, each of us would take one room. And if we heard someone trying to come in, or somebody was shooting, trying to come in, that we would yell help. And then we'd all rush to that room and just try to overpower whoever was trying to come in. We created our own little triage. We separated people into different rooms. We had a guy named Dylan. He had a gunshot wound to the right side of his shoulder. I think he was the most critical. We had a lot of people with lacerations from that damn fence. And then we had like an elderly lady with a broken ankle. So we started separating them. And the reason we did that is, you know, if they see a guy bleeding out, usually the people with less severe injuries, they're going to panic, and they might even go into shock because now they're seeing this guy. He's on his last lifeline over here. So that's why we did that. We ended up taking count, and that's how we found out there were 62 of us in there. I didn't really know what else to do, so I ended up calling the watch commander from my department. And I told him, hey, this is where we're at. This is what we have. We have people that are in here injured. And he ends up telling me, okay, let me call Metro PD and I'll call you back. He does. He ends up calling me back about 2 minutes later. And he's like, hey, I had talked to Metro PD. They told me they have bodies everywhere and you guys are on your own. So I'm like, okay. I'll kind of keep that information to myself. I'm not going to go cause panic. So we're in there. He actually ends up calling me about 2 minutes later. And he's like, hey, I just talked to Metro again. He said they have someone waiting for you guys outside. So I'm like, okay, perfect. So this is my time. I'm like, now I'm going to tell my wife that Metro's waiting for us outside. I'm going to be able to go outside and she's going to stay in here. And if I just happen to go back to the venue, then so be it. I end up going outside and there's no one there. There's no one waiting for us. You know, typical, everybody's here and there's no one there. But I do see lights coming from Reno Avenue. So I'm like, okay, let me run down to Reno and let me see what I could do. I end up making it down to Reno Avenue. And I end up seeing there's a female police officer there and she's in front of her patrol car. I go make contact with her. I'm like, hey, I'm a police officer. Give me a rifle. And she's like, man, I don't have a rifle. All I have is this shotgun and my sidearm. And I'm like, okay. Well, I have this building. There's 62 people in there. We have gunshot wound victims. I give her the whole breakdown. And she's like, okay, perfect. Start bringing them out here because Reno Avenue is actually going to be the staging area where they're going to start transporting all the injured victims. So I'm like, okay, cool. I end up going there. I run back to the building where I'm at. And when I get back to that building, they don't want to let me in. So I'm like, hey, man, I just came out of here. Let me in. And they're like, no, fuck out of here. And then I'm like, dude, I was the cop in there. I just came out of there. Let me in. And they're like, no, we're not letting you in. Get the hell out of here. I'm like, hey, man, my wife's in there. Come on, guys, let me in. And I do hear a guy say, hey, there was a cop that was in here. This place had video cameras on the outside. So they're like, all right, show us your fucking badge then. So I do. I take my badge out. I show it to the camera. And they actually let me in.
Okay.
I make it inside. I make an announcement. Hey, Metro's here. They want us all to come out. They're going to start transporting everybody to the hospital. So everybody's like, yeah, well, fuck you. We're not leaving. We're staying in here. But Metro, no, yeah, we're staying in here. However, Dylan, he had a gunshot wound to the right side of his shoulder. He's like, hey, man, I'm feeling really dizzy. I'm about to pass out. I'll go with you.
Yeah, he's like, I'm out.
Yeah. Dylan is with his girlfriend, and he's ready to go. So I'm like, okay, cool. So me, my wife, and his girlfriend, we actually end up picking him up. We leave the place. We run down to Reno Avenue. We try to load him in the first ambulance, and they're like, no, get out of here. We got a guy with a gunshot wound to the right side of his head. Okay. We take him to the next ambulance, and they're like, no, we have a guy with a gunshot wound to his stomach. We're basically going down the line. Nobody wants this guy. They're like, I don't think he's critical. It's just his shoulder, and he'll be all right. Take him to the Metro buses. They're going down there too. We end up finding the Metro bus, and he's like, yeah, I'm going to the hospital. You guys can come in here. So we end up going in there, besides myself, my wife, and Dylan's girlfriend. We're the only three in that bus that don't have gunshot wounds. And it's like, why we were chosen, I have no idea. Everybody else on that bus has a gunshot wound somewhere. I had never seen anything like that. I've seen gunshot wounds before, but not in the masses. We end up taking off from there. They take us to Sunrise Hospital. Usually I'm pretty good with directions. At this point, I have lost all sense of direction. I don't know if I'm going north, south, east, west. I don't know if I'm going up or down. But when we get to the hospital, there's one nurse and one doctor at the emergency entrance with a whole bus full of people that are coming to them. And we're just the first ones. We were actually the first bus that made it to the hospital. So I tell my wife, hey, man, I'm not staying here. I said, there's a lot of people that are going to die tonight, and I don't want to see that. Let's get out of here. So I lost all sense of direction. We take off running from the hospital, and we're just running down the street. I don't really know where I'm going. The only thing I know is where Las Vegas Boulevard is, because I could see the casinos. And I'm like, okay, well, my timeshare is around that area, so let's keep running in that direction. We find a Metro bus. We go and ask the driver, hey, do you mind if we jump on here? We were just involved. There's a shooting taking place. And he's like, yeah, just jump on. I'm not going that way, but I'll take you to the end of my route. We end up jumping on there. He does. He takes us to the end of his route. And then we get off the bus. I have no idea where I'm at still. We are closer to the strip, but we're still really far. We start running again like maniacs. Really don't know where we're going, but we're running. And at some point, my wife makes eye contact with a car that's making a right turn. There's two females in the car, and she approaches them. She starts talking to them, and she's like pleading with them, can you guys please give us a ride? We're trying to get back to our hotel. It looks like they're kind of deciding. I remember, hey, I have $200 cash in my wallet. I pull out $200, and I tell him, hey, please take us back to our hotel. I'll give you $200 cash right now. The driver looks at me, and she's like, hey, man, we don't want your money. Just jump in. So we end up getting in the back seat. I'm on the driver's, on the back seat, the driver's side. My wife's in the passenger side. We start driving, or the driver starts driving. And she's like, hey, do you know what's going on? And I said, you know what? I think there's an active shooter, at least one, at the Mandalay Bay. When I told her that, this girl ends up crashing into the center divider.
Oh.
And the car's still going. So I end up going from the rear driver's seat. I end up grabbing the steering wheel, and I bring us back onto the road. She comes to a stop, and I'm like, hey, get out of the cart. Let me drive. And she's like, no, I'm going to drive. I'm like, let me drive. I'm okay. Let me drive. And she's like, no. I'm like, are you okay? And she's like, well, that's where we were going because my sister just called me that they're on lockdown. So I told her all of this. I didn't know her sister, obviously, was in the casino, but that's where they were driving to. Anyway, this poor girl ends up driving us back to our hotel. And that's just the first part of my story, man. It just, I can go on for another hour and tell you guys all of the stuff that happened there. Oh, man.
Would you be, because I have another friend of mine who was an officer at the event, but you know, if you wouldn't mind coming back, we could sit down with him and you guys can kind of talk about, because what happens after that is a whole other saga and story into and of itself. So if you wouldn't mind, that'd be,
yeah, I'll tell you what the aftermath, I don't know if it might even be worse than the actual incident. Right. I'll tell you this. We've been close to divorce. We've been close to losing our house. I've been close to losing my kids. I've been close to losing my job. I've been close to, you know, you have to be very careful the words you use, because then you go in for fitness for duty. But I've been close to, like, these dark places that people don't want to talk about.
Right.
Honestly, the aftermath might be worse than the actual incident. They're both horrible in the same sense, but it might even be more horrible than the incident.
Yeah, I get that. Well, I mean, if anybody has any doubts about how something like this can affect you, you know, they have no concept necessarily of how, you don't know, first of all, you don't know how you're going to react till you have to react, right? Like the cowboy hat thing. You know, that's your instinctive reactive brain going, oh, I dropped my hat. And then your conscious, you know, brain going, dumbass, we have something bigger than that to worry about. And then those conflicts later on cause you to second guess, why did I think that? Why did this? Why did? And you start to what if yourself into oblivion, and you question every single decision you made that night, because could I have done it better? Did I do my best? What, you know? My buddy who was there was off duty, and he said it was like being Clark Kent without his super suit. You know, you just can't do anything.
Yeah,
it's exactly. Incredibly, for guys that are in a profession where we're trained to, and gals in a profession that are trained to, you know, go in and handle business, to be put in a position where you can't is like literally nightmare fuel. It's the stuff that we have nightmares about being stuck in a position where something's happening and you can't do anything, you know. So
I'll tell you, like, I truly believe, and it's gonna sound weird, but it actually makes sense. I got to attend the FBI debrief, and they explained to you the other side of it. And basically what I feel is a security guard, a mom and her baby, saved a lot of lives that night. And you're probably like, what the hell are you talking about? And I don't know if we have time for that, but it makes sense. Like, it really does make sense. So this is what happened on the other side, on the casino side. A mom ended up taking, she had a newborn baby. She ended up going to Vegas to party with her friends. They actually were, they got the penthouse next to the shooter. They got two penthouses, one next to the shooter and one right across. That mom ended up leaving her baby in the hotel room alone. She ended up leaving the door open. You know, you could put that latch.
Yeah, yeah.
She put the latch.
Keep it open a crack.
And went across to party with her friends. Because you're a high roller and you left your door room open, it automatically sends an alert to security. Hey, a high roller left their door open. Which I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I don't know. Well, it's good to know, guys. Keep it in mind if you're ever a high roller.
Put the latch down.
I don't think I'll ever be a high roller, but damn.
So their security guard ended up going to, this was on the 32nd floor. He made it up to the 32nd floor. He tried to, they have push doors there. He tried to push through a door and noticed it was locked. He ended up going down to the 31st floor. He took the service elevator up, came up the other side, and noticed somebody had drilled L brackets into the push bar door. So he ended up calling like their maintenance and operation people and saying, hey man, this is a fire issue. You guys need to remove this. Like, I don't know who put this, but you guys need to remove it. At that point, the shooter, I always call him shooter. I never call him by his name because I don't think he deserves it. This guy had cameras, obviously. He had them on a food cart. He had them on his door. He thought this was a police officer that figured out where he was at. Remember I told you there was never a pause in that shooting until 4 minutes in?
Right.
Well, this was 4 minutes in. This guy ends up walking the hallway. He thinks it's a police officer. He turns his rifle from the crowd, and he turns it to the security guard and starts shooting. He shot off 200 rounds at that security guard, which the security guard ended up jumping into one of the alcoves on that floor. He ended up taking one in the leg and basically took cover in that alcove. But that was what gave us the opportunity to run. Without that security guard, without that baby, without that mom leaving the door open, like, this guy would have got, it would have been more than 58 people, I think.
And then SWAT knows where to respond, and there's, yeah.
Right.
Right.
So anyways, the maintenance and operation people come up, and now he thinks, oh, more cops are coming. He ends up turning around and shooting towards them too. He ends up shooting 200 rounds at them. He shot 1,100 rounds at the crowd. He killed 58 people. He wounded, I believe it was 481 people took gunshot wounds. And it was over, I think the initial number was like over 800 people that were injured.
Right.
But I mean, I'm sure it went higher than that after. He had 26 rifles. He had, his magazines were like double stacked. So he had one facing one way, one facing down, and then taped them together.
Right.
So he would just flip them out. He never actually got to flip any magazines, because he had so many rifles. So he ended up, what he was doing and why there was no pauses, he would empty the whole rifle, put it down and grab the next one, shoot it, put it down, grab the next one. And that's what he did. He had, I believe it was 26, homemade IEDs. He had, wind directional charts taped to the window. He had, his own breathing apparatus that he made out of scuba gear.
Just in case of gas.
Just in case. This guy was ready. He was ready for war. He was ready for war. They don't think that his plan was just to shoot people at the venue. Remember I told you I heard bells ringing? He got 8 rounds in the fuel tanks at the airport. But he knew. Here's the thing about fuel that I didn't even know. So it's very hard to ignite aviation fuel.
Mm-hmm.
You can't ignite aviation fuel by shooting a round into it. You have to ignite the fumes that are coming out of the tanks.
Right.
So that's what he did. He was trying to ignite those fumes. He shot a round into there, which let the fumes out.
Right.
And then the next 7, he was trying to ignite spark that. Right. What the FBI said is if that tank would have gone off, there would have been more than 22,000 people dead. Basically, anyone in that vicinity would have been gone. Luckily, it didn't ignite. His plan, which was much greater, for some reason, his girlfriend helped them load all the rounds because he found her fingerprints on it.
Mm-hmm.
And when they asked her if she knew anything about it, she said, nope, I had no idea. But he had deposited money into her account. The only thing she told the FBI was that 6 months prior to their breakup, his sex drive had fallen almost completely. And he started watching a lot of child porn in the last six months. 3 days before the shooting, he checked, or I'm sorry, on September 26th, he checked into the Mandalay Bay. He brought in, I believe it was a total of 21 suitcases. And on that same day he checked in, he paid $600,000 in debt to the casinos that he owed. On that same day, he paid $100,000 to credit card companies that he owed money to. So he came in paying off debt. They found all his computers, cell phones, laptops, except one hard drive that they haven't found till today. But they pretty much found everything else. There's all the testing they did, they have no idea till this day what triggered him to do this, whether it was he was against law enforcement or right. What have you.
And if they do know, they're not telling.
Yeah.
So
till this day, I still believe there was more than one shooter. And I always say, well, you know, why would they you know, unless it's like liability lawsuits, whatever, why would they hide anything like that? I till this day, I think I heard more than one gun going off, different calibers, from different places. But like I said, there is a lot of echoes. There's a lot of what ifs. The good things that have changed in Vegas since is now every venue, well, I don't know now because now nobody's pro police, but before this whole thing, a SWAT team is at every venue now. 2 hours prior to any venue that's outdoor, any facing casino, they do pre-checks on those rooms. They have 6,000 tourniquets available at every venue, which is why most of those 58 people died. They basically bled out. And what ended up happening with the ambulances in the hospitals is the ambulance were taking patients to the hospital, bandaging them up the best they could, get them to the hospital. The hospital was getting so many patients that they ended up running out of medical supplies. When the ambulance would get there, they would strip the ambulance. The ambulance would go back for more people, and now they had nothing to stop bleeding, to do anything. So a lot of people died on transport too. But like I said, that's you know, my story of the incident, and there's the whole other, what we talked about, the whole other backside that I think might even be worse personally. You know, and that's something we can discuss.
Yeah, if you're willing to come back and tell it, we're absolutely, because I think that's a side of things people need to hear, is the aftermath can be worse than the event. You know, obviously the event's scary, but it's when it's over and you've survived. Okay, now phase two, and phase two is using a shovel and digging your way out of all the shit that just got dumped on you.
Yeah, and I've questioned, like you know, you sit there and you question all the time, like all the what ifs, and I always question, like, why was I so fortunate to make it out, and the guy next to me basically took a bullet for me, like why? And the reason I talk about this is because, you know, hopefully my story, whoever listens, my story will help them. If they're ever involved in an incident like this, they'll think like, oh shit, I got to do something. Don't just stay there and take cover. React. Use your training to the best of your ability and react. And that's the way why I talk about it. Usually I talk to the new officers about that. Because like you said, you have your plan A when you're off duty, and then your plan A goes to shit. And then it's, well, okay, we'll go with plan B. Plan B goes to shit. You got to have multiple plans. Don't just stick to that. I'm going to give you the code word and everything's going to go. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
Especially off duty. Like you said, you have nothing on you.
Yeah. Yeah. I can tell you, you know, you've got cases where an officer working with his cops, this happened in New York. He works with these cops every day. He goes down to change in the locker room. This was years and years ago, but we used to teach it when we would teach advanced officer safety. And he went downstairs in his own precinct, went to the locker room, changed into his civilian clothes. It was like t-shirt and jeans. And a suspect got loose upstairs and got a gun and started shooting. And so he runs upstairs in his t-shirt and jeans with a gun to kill the suspect. And he gets friendly fired and killed. And these are his own men. They know him. They work with him. And yet, in a crisis, they didn't even recognize him. It was just a guy with a gun. So off-duty scenarios can be just as dangerous, if not worse, than on-duty scenarios. And they can also have a much more vicious mental effect because, you know, we don't understand sometimes we don't understand the depth to which we're going to hold ourselves responsible for things that are completely out of our control, because we're not even supposed to be doing anything. We're supposed to be just living our civilian life. Yeah. So,
and those decisions you make off duty, they're going to haunt you, you know, and you got to learn how to deal with that, because they're going to haunt you your whole life. You just got to learn how to deal with that. The decisions you made on that day, or that I made on that day, I have to learn how to live with that. Yeah. And that's just the bottom line. And that's why I talk to the officers, the younger guys. And it's like, the decisions you make at work or off work, that's the ones you're going to have to live with. And you got to learn how to live with them.
Yeah. And ahead of time. Don't try and figure it out after.
Yeah. Right.
Like, it doesn't work as well after as it does beforehand.
Sure.
So
have your person, man. Have your person. You know, my advice is always have that person that you can tell them anything.
Right.
Because, you know, you're a cop. You can't come home and tell your wife, hey, this happened. You can't tell your supervisor fitness for duty. You can't tell your therapist they'll take you off work. But have that person that you can be like, hey, man, this is how I'm feeling today right now, and I need you to save me. You got to have that go-to person.
And if you don't, we've had Randy Sutton on, and we've talked about him, but a great organization you can reach out to is the Wounded Blue. Mm-hmm. They specialize in, you know, peer assistance and counseling for first responders, especially police officers who have been through the shit or been through a critical incident, and their department either won't or can't, you know, treat them or help them because they're afraid to come forward. I mean, I can't even tell you how many people I've talked to that have either come forward and lost their job because they were willing to ask for help or are not willing to come forward and ask for help because they know they'll lose their job.
You know, and sadly, and you know, we've had it on other episodes, and Alex, obviously you don't need to comment on this, but being is that I've worked for that department before, and myself being in a critical incident there, while you guys went through that critical incident, you know, it's fucking bullshit that, you know, these places don't, they don't give you the support that you need. I don't work for them anymore, so I don't really give a fuck. And they didn't. And that's bullshit. I was very vocal about that when I was there. And it is what it is.
And by being vocal, you immediately put a target on your back.
Yeah, I had a target on my back before that.
No, but my point is that anybody.
Yeah, so they just, it just needs, there just needs to be more awareness.
Right.
Yeah, and I really don't understand what the big issue is about talking about stuff like that. To me, it's like it's going to help my fellow brother or sister get through something that one day they might have to face.
Right.
But when you're like in a management position or some kind of leadership position and you don't want to talk about those things, to me, it's like you're not a good leader. That's detrimental to the department as a whole.
Yeah. No, you're right.
So, well, I think we'll have you back as soon as possible because I can't wait to hear the second half to that and the aftermath, and we'll see if we can get another friend of mine who was there because you guys can kind of compare notes, as it were. Sometimes that alone isn't enough. It's just to compare notes with somebody else who was there and say, yeah, I felt this. Oh my God, I felt that too. Oh, mm-hmm. Do you remember when this happened? Do you remember? And then you say it. It makes it real. You've said it out loud. You've gotten it out. And then it allows you to think about it more clearly because you're not so in your own head and up your own ass about it. So,
sure. Yeah. No, thank you for coming in.
Yeah, thank you.
And thank you for sharing that. And, you know, I wasn't there. I've had similar situations, but I wasn't there. And in my opinion, and I think in everyone's opinion, you did an amazing job.
Yeah. So right. You're alive, your wife's alive, and the rest of that stuff, it was out of your hands.
That's it.
So don't hold yourself responsible for things that you can't be held responsible for. You know, because you're already going to hold yourself responsible for things that you want to be responsible for, let alone things you can't even control. So, I think that, you know, we've gone a little bit over time, but appreciate you. It's okay. You know, it's totally fine. So until our next episode, come home with your shield or armor.